This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. Tonight we have two individuals who joined us for a special guest panel. First one is Seth Lay. Seth was born and raised LDS, went to seminary, went to BYU, served a mission, returned to BYU, graduated with a BA in German and a minor in physics and mathematics. Wow, that's a lot. Did some work in computer science and completed a master's degree in computer science. Seth, you currently work in the computer field?
Yes, I do.
Seth, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Our second guest is Lauren. Lauren was raised in a traditional LDS family, served his two-year mission, had a Mormon temple marriage, graduated from BYU with a bachelor's degree in molecular biology. Lauren then earned his PhD from the University of California and currently conducts independently funded cancer research at a medical center in New York City. Lauren, welcome.
Thanks, John.
Well, just to give our kind of the background so we know where you're coming from, why don't we go ahead and start with you, Seth, and kind of let us know your journey out of Mormonism and where you got to today.
Okay. Well, as far as the journey out of Mormonism goes, I really kind of wanted to mention how my views on science had kind of affected the viability of my testimony over the years, because I was 36 when I actually, you know, realized or decided that the church wasn't true after all, and it took me a very long time to get to that point. What I wanted to mention was that, you know, back when I was around 12 or 13, I had believed for a very short time that evolution must be false and that the flood happened and that carbon 12 dating was wrong and all the sort of typical objections of people who, you know, are literal believers in like the Genesis story and things like that. I think I was sort of led to believe that way by, you know, some teachers I had in church or things that I had heard, you know, quotes from prophets, probably Joseph Fielding Smith and people like that. That lasted a very short time. I know that very quickly in high school, I had come to realize that the science was well-founded and it was credible, and had pretty much decided that the science in these matters was probably true, and that the, you know, the opinions of like the prophets and people who had spoke against that, those things, was probably not true, was probably not credible. It kind of bugged me in a way. Like most people, I think I was able to compartmentalize that and say, well, you know, that wasn't relevant to my salvation or something like that. Another incident I can remember in my earlier life that was kind of a big deal, actually, was when I sat down with my wife in a car, like parked outside the South Jordan Temple in Utah, and like confessed to her that I believed in evolution and science and did not believe in the prophets, where these prophets conflicted with science. And she was actually kind of surprised by that. She was shocked. In fact, I think she was shaken to the core. I know it sounds kind of funny to say, but it's like, yes, we had like a serious problem in our relationship where I confessed that there were circumstances under which I, you know, did not believe the words of the prophets, because I, you know, I believed the science instead. So that was a pretty big issue. I like to characterize this as like the chink in the armor of my faith, which was my first realization that the prophets could actually be wrong, because in the past I'd had this sort of testimony that whatever the prophets said, well, I mean, they're the prophets, you know, they talk to God, they must be right. So it is kind of momentous that the science caused me to first realize that the prophets could be wrong about something. I think later on, just the last couple of years before I realized that the church wasn't true, I remember reading an article about cults. And let me make clear, I'm not saying that the LDS church is a cult. So just, you know, people don't jump to conclusions that that's what I'm talking about. But it was an article about cults, and the kinds of practices that lead cult members to burrow into the cult rather than run screaming away from it, you know, in face of some of the, you know, sometimes ridiculous beliefs that cults often have. And I started to recognize like similarities between some of the practices and things like that of these cults or religions and how they kind of indoctrinate people and stuff like that. And I was like, well, we kind of do that. You know, I was still a believer, but I was kind of uncomfortable about the fact that, you know, cult specialists could talk about indoctrination techniques that would lead people to like believe things that weren't true and then realize that, you know, that our own practices in the LDS culture shared a lot of similarities with that. Right before I lost my testimony for good, I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine who's in the Catholic seminary, and he was telling me his story of how he came to believe that God wanted him to become a Catholic priest. And he was reading the scriptures, that is the Bible, because that's, you know, his only scripture. He was praying to God earnestly, asking for guidance, and he felt revelation from God. And he's told me it was inspiration to his mind directly from God that he should go to the priesthood. And I remember when he was telling me this, thinking to myself, well, wow, that's like pretty much exactly what LDS people do to receive guidance from God. And we believe that that really is guidance from God. But, you know, how could this friend of mine receive a testimony through the same mechanism that we receive our testimonies, that the Catholic Church was true and that the Pope really was, you know, the Bishop of Christ on earth, and that he should go and, you know, join this priesthood. So, I mean, it really did kind of give me, along with the thing about the cults and their techniques, a little bit more reason to be introspective about what I believed and why I believed it. And then combining that with the realization that prophets could be wrong about the scientific things, I really did kind of get to this crisis point. Of course, what actually triggered it for me in the end was reading apologetics about the Book of Abraham and Joseph Smith. When I saw some of the bad arguments that were being made, I just said, that's it. I mean, we are exactly the same as all those false churches out there in the world. There's not a bit of difference. And as soon as I realized that and decided to stop, you know, privileging the arguments in favor of the church in my own mind and just sort of take the evidence to where it led, that was a done deal. So that's kind of my 5-minute rundown.
Great. Thanks, Seth. Lauren, how about setting the stage for yourself?
So I was always interested in science as a kid. So when I went to BYU, I took, you know, some honors science classes my freshman year. And I remember taking a biology class, an honors biology class, where we were supposed to write a paper. I think it was about a controversial topic. And some of the, you know, ideas that people were writing about were creation versus evolution, and things like that. And so I wrote one about, you know, the flood. And, you know, my paper was that the flood couldn't have happened. And here's all the reasons why. And, you know, I got a good grade on the paper, and that was like an accepted topic of discussion, an accepted thing to write about in an honors biology class at BYU. So then when I got to the MTC, I remember I had a teacher that I really, really enjoyed his personality, but we would fight, in front of the class about evolution and creation and the flood and those things, because he was a zoology major at BYU, and he was a fundamentalist, you know, anti-scientific believer in all of these religious dogmas. And it really, it frustrated me. It gave me a distraction in the MTC as well. You know, I didn't have any reference materials to go to try and prove him wrong. It was just kind of, you know, arguing. I don't know. And he didn't like it. He didn't like it because it took away from the spirit of the class. So it didn't go on for very long. But anyway, when I was on my mission, the president of my mission for a long time was a physics university professor. That is what he did before he became a mission president. And so, you know, we had some interesting discussions about science, and he had some ideas that were really out of the norm, kind of transhumanist ideas about how science would interface with the second coming, and through science, you know, resurrection would become possible and immortality. You know, I had never heard anything like that. But that was, I guess, sort of his way of making science and the gospel fit together. Anyway, so when I got back off my mission, I didn't want to, at first, because I didn't really enjoy my freshman year at BYU, but I ended up going back to BYU, and continuing, you know, with my interest in science. And I remember in my biology classes when I went back to BYU, the professors would, almost always, you know, in the big general biology class, they would have a couple of days where they would just have to sort of put out the fires, because they were going to talk about evolution next, and they had to get everyone ready to just study the science and not be conflicted about what the church had taught them in seminary and Sunday school. You know, so they pulled out all the quotes from, you know, Talmage and B.H. Roberts and these more progressive Mormon leaders who had, you know, kind of said good things about evolution. So, you know, I always thought that was kind of interesting. Once again, a different way that people in the church grapple with science and how it seems to conflict with some traditional Mormon beliefs. I guess, though, it was during this time that I was really kind of bored with church, to be honest. And was kind of just going to church, you know, the minimum amount to continue to get my ecclesiastical endorsement to go to BYU. And I remember one day I was at home, skipping church, in Provo. And there was a knock at my door, and I answered the door, and it was the Jehovah's Witnesses proselytizing. And it was just like a shock, you know? I mean, I met lots of Jehovah's Witnesses when I was a missionary. But here I was on the other side, and they were proselytizing me, and they believed in their religion just as much as I believed in mine from before. And kind of, I would have to say, as much as science was sort of a little bit of a difficulty in belief, it was the recognition that there were so many other religions who believed in themselves just as strongly as Mormons believed that kind of made me say, you know, faith can't resolve anything. You can't figure out the truth by just sticking with what you have always believed, you know, and falling back on faith. And so that was pretty critical, I think, for the things that came afterwards. So my final year at BYU, I worked in a laboratory at BYU that was working on, you know, human DNA, and migration of human populations. And, you know, I came to trust DNA, at least the science. You know, it's not voodoo. It's not like reading a fingerprint where it's an, you know, it's kind of, you have a lot of experience maybe and you think you can tell one fingerprint from another. No, it's like digital accuracy, you know, A, T, G, C. These are base pairs that can be, you know, identified with precision and tracked. I came to trust that and came to start to think a little bit about, you know, what we know about where the Native Americans came from. And I knew what I had always learned in church, you know, maybe even not that the Lamanites, the people of Lehi were the only people who came to America, but that was sort of like the explanation for, you know, why there were people here. And when I finished at BYU and I went to interview, at graduate schools, I went to one school where, one of the professors that I was chatting with in his office, he had looked up, you know, the people who wrote me letters of reference and saw that one of the professors, the lab where I had worked as a senior student, one of these professors was kind of renowned for tracking human population migration using DNA and ancient DNA. And he asked me, wow, how does this guy account for the Book of Mormon? And that was like, wow, I realized then that people outside of the church were kind of thinking the same thing I was thinking. And this was in the mid-1990s. This was before Thomas Murphy and well before Simon Southerton. And it kind of stuck with me. You know, it was kind of a second experience, like the Jehovah's Witnesses looking at Mormons from the outside. And here was, you know, a professor. I don't know what his religious background was. I have no idea. He may well have been, you know, an atheist, but he had sort of seen this problem and confronted me with it in a casual way. So after I finished BYU, I tried to go back to the church. I was married and, you know, was going to have my first child. And I tried to go back and just sit in some sacrament meetings and try and view it from an outsider's point of view. And it was just, I just couldn't do it. You know, looking at it from the mindset of an outsider, it was just not spiritual and it was strange. And many of the things that were said were incredible to me. And so I pretty much after that, I decided to separate myself from the church. And, you know, basically I didn't want my children to grow up believing those things. And that's why at that time I decided that that was the end for me. So, yeah, basically that's it for me. That was, you know, that was many years ago. That was in the mid, that was kind of mid to late 90s when all those things happened. And since then I've just, you know, I haven't believed in Mormonism. And there was a brief, maybe a couple of days where I flirted with the idea of finding another church, you know, another Christian church or something. And I just kind of a lot of philosophical issues that popped into my head. And it just seemed like the easiest thing was the most simplest thing was that if there's no evidence for a God that I can see, then there probably isn't one. And I've sort of just don't really label myself an atheist because I think people, I think that in the common people's mind, there's a lot of bad things associated with that word. And I just don't want to have to diffuse that every time I talk about it. So I just, you know, I'm a skeptic. I think people can appreciate skepticism in many aspects of life. And, you know, if I just respond that I'm a skeptic in regards to evolution or, that was a slip in regards to, religion, then, you know, that should be understandable to most people. And that's where I am today.
It's been pointed out that, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of the, let's say, information published against the church or the anti-Mormon movement or however you want to classify it was coming from the evangelical sectors. And now, especially with the internet, has moved to more of a secularist view. What do you guys think the role of science and scientific education is in that?
I think it's just become, how should I say it? Mormonism is mainstreaming, so it's in a lot of ways a lot harder to get away with wacky ideas like a vast scientific conspiracy to hide God from the masses or something like that. You know, like when you think about 100 years ago, 150 years ago, Mormons were like way out there. You know, we believed in all kinds of wacky things that the rest of the world didn't believe in. We were kind of isolated in Utah. Things like that. It was really easy for a prophet to stand up and say, no, Adam and Eve really were the first human beings, and, you know, 6,000 years ago. And, you know, the flood was baptized by this, you know, the earth was baptized by this great flood, you know, 5,000 years ago or something like that. And people in the church would be like, yeah, that's true. And all those people who say it's not true are part of that world out there that we're like against. But, you know, of course, the science back then was relatively new. That would kind of disprove those things. I think we've kind of grown into an era where the science is so firmly established now that there can really be no doubt that human beings have been around for like a couple hundred thousand years and that the flood, that there's no evidence that this kind of worldwide flood has ever happened in the last few thousand years and wiped out people and, you know, stuff like that and wiped out all people except, you know, eight or whatever. I mean, there's just, those things are simply no longer viable beliefs to anybody with any kind of an education. And that includes the Mormons because, you know, unlike 100 years ago where we could sort of flip the bird intellectually to the rest of the world and say, you guys just don't get it. We've kind of moved into the world where we're sort of like, you know, BYU is pumping out, you know, PhDs by the hundreds every year in hard sciences. And there is no such thing as like LDS science at BYU. It's just science. You know, I studied physics for a while at BYU. There was no LDS physics. It was just physics. And you simply can't have people come out of that environment anymore to buy into the conspiracy theory like things. You know, it's like, I think it's a lot easier for a Mormon to believe in evolution now and to disbelieve in the flood and things like that than it ever, you know, than it ever was at any other time.
Yeah, you put it pretty well, Seth. Although I had a professor at BYU who taught molecular biology and immunology, and he would, any chance he could, he would say evolution. You know, he wouldn't just teach science. He would teach Mormon science and try and slip Mormonism into there. So I still think there are people in church, even, you know, high level, people with scientific training who still have, I don't know how they do it. Honestly, I can't understand how people can believe this way, but still feel that there are accepted things that are, you know, rock solid accepted in science. Like if humans have been on the earth for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, there's still people who doubt that, who should know better. Right.
How old was this professor? I'm just curious.
He was, you know, in the 90s. He was in his 40s, probably.
Huh. I was just kind of wondering, like, whether or not he had grown up in the era of, like, Joseph Fielding Smith, for example, or whether he had grown up, you know.
No way. No, he was not a fossil. And I've talked to other people who had him, and, yeah, he was kind of renowned for being that way.
You know, I think about my time at BYU, and I came away, even though when I graduated I still had a testimony, I had firmly dismantled the flood, the Tower of Babel, all of the myths that professors had walked that through. And most of the time the professors that I had would teach the straight line for almost all the days. And then one day they would take kind of a testimony, sort of post-modern slant on everything to kind of contextualize it. But really, you know, the science of evolution was firmly established for me when I was there.
Yeah, I guess I don't remember any physics professors having to bear their testimonies simply because, you know, physics itself isn't that controversial. You know, it's not like, you know, quantum physics contradicts the Book of Mormon in any way or anything like that. So maybe I just didn't see that because of the discipline I was studying at the time, you know, whereas in biology, obviously the conflicts would be right in your face.
Yeah, that's true. I remember though, my mission president, who was the physicist, there was a rumor around the mission that he was going to win a Nobel Prize because under his bed, he had a box full of scientific proof that the Big Bang did not happen.
Wow. Yeah, that's like wishful thinking right there, right?
Yeah, totally.
So, I mean, that leads to another question that I have. I went to BYU and I have friends who went to BYU, and some of us came out with a mainstream scientific understanding. Others went to the same place, received the same education. They can understand evolution and that sort of thing, but they're still able to dismiss it. And this is a real head scratcher for me. You know, we talked a couple of weeks ago on the podcast about the Pew Forum, where 80% of Mormons basically still believe in the traditional biblical 6,000 years and the flood scenario. How is it that so many Mormons are being educated in science, but are still able to hold on to these fundamentalist beliefs?
Well, okay, wait a second. Okay, 80% of Mormons who go to BYU are studying, you know, political science and marketing and English and, you know, things like that. You know, I mean, I would dare say that the overwhelming majority of BYU graduates didn't get any closer to evolution than physical science 101.
Yeah, that's probably right? True.
Yeah. That's probably true, yeah.
And if you look at the university, I mean, what's the two places where they're spending most of their money? It's in the law school and the business school, which of course are both completely indifferent to the truth value of science.
That's the apostle factory right there.
You know, well, then there's the other question. I mean, you're asking how come everybody who goes to BYU doesn't come away, you know, fully educated in science? And accepting of evolution, for example. But, you know, what about the other question? I think it's a bigger question, is why isn't it that everyone who learns about evolution and science becomes an unbeliever, like, you know, Seth and I and you know, other people? Most people who go to BYU and get a science education stay Mormon, don't they?
Probably true.
I don't know. That's a good question. It's hard to say. And I think this leads to another question that's out there that's been asked many, many times, which is, why are so many people who leave the church becoming sort of atheistic? Well, outside of BYU, we don't have really good track over how many people, you know, go to the University of Chicago who are Mormon and then, you know, become agnostic scientific sort of thinkers. The church isn't publishing that. But there seems to be a real trend on the, at least on the online communities and those who write about this sort of thing, that Mormonism leads to sort of deep agnosticism.
Well, actually, can we back up for just one moment? Because it just occurred to me, we were sort of talking about, you know, why did people come out of BYU still believing? And I guess my situation is different from Lauren's, because it sounds like he came out of BYU pretty much already on the track of unbelief. And I didn't. You know, I mean, I was a firm believer. I was as TBM as it gets. And I really didn't, I don't know. I probably stopped going to BYU full time in like maybe 1994. I continued taking some classes part time, trying to finish, a degree. And, I would say another 10 years between the time I stopped going to BYU full time and the time I actually became an unbeliever. So how did I take all the way up to like the 400 level classes in physics, and graduate from BYU with a degree and, minors in math and physics, and still believe in the church? Because by then I did firmly, you know, disbelieve in the flood and all that. And I guess the reason for me, and probably the same, reason for a lot of other Mormons who graduated, is just, it wasn't, I was able to say, this is not relevant to my eternal salvation, right? It's like, Jesus has to be the Christ and Joseph Smith had to be a true prophet, but it's not true that evolution has to be false, you know, in order for it to believe in the church. I actually don't believe that's true anymore. I think people are really sort of dancing around it a little bit too cavalierly. But at the time, I was able to make that work in my mind that, you know, the prophets can be wrong on this, but that's okay because they're right on the things that really matter. And I would bet that that's probably the approach that, 99% of Mormon scientists will take.
Yeah, I think so too. And that's why I sort of, now when I talk about why I stopped believing and why people stop believing, I don't focus so much on the issues. The issues are easy to talk about, but what's more important is the context. And for me, those issues came up in the context of being bored with the church and discontent and realizing that there were all these other religions out there who had just as much going for them as Mormonism. And so in that context, these other issues, the scientific issues and kind of the historical issues about, the church and, Joseph Smith, his personal behaviors and things, those, I didn't really feel like sweeping them under the rug, And I think that people who are happy in the church and that's their life, they are able to do that with ease and they can do it for as long as they're happy in the church.
I wanted to segue with my comment. It kind of continues that, but segue into the theme that John was just leading us into, which is why atheism after, after Mormonism. I think it has to do with, for me, I was a true believer. To me, the celestial kingdom was like a real place. Elohim was this real guy out there someplace in or out of the universe. I couldn't say, but he was real. This was as real as it gets. To me, the existence of the celestial kingdom was just as real to me as, anything from physics or chemistry or anything like that. You see what I mean? It's like, we know that airplanes fly because of certain principles of physics. Well, I knew that the celestial kingdom existed in the same exact way. It took a very long time for me to kind of question that. And what happened in my case was not that I was like bored with the church or whatever. It was really that I had to think long and hard about what I knew and why I knew it. It was sort of like my epistemology. I had to decide whether or not I had a proper basis for determining that something was true or not. I mean, this is just like going back to my friend, the Catholic seminarian. he knew that the Catholic Church was true. And the problem is, I knew that the Mormon Church was true in the same way and for the same types of reasons that he knew that. Well, he's, as a Mormon, I could say he was obviously wrong because the Catholic Church isn't true. Well, why can he be wrong using the same method to identify truth that I was using, and yet I'm not wrong, and I can be confident that I'm not wrong? See what I mean? That was a nagging question. It really, really bugged me a lot. And so, in terms of why I've gone from being a believer in the church to not believing in God at all, rather than going to some other church, is that in order for me to become a non-believer in the Mormon church, I had to understand not only that the church was wrong, but how it was wrong in every aspect, and how I had become convinced falsely that it was true in every way. It's like really, like, comprehensively understand, you know, how I could have fallen for the same type of thing that, like, my friend fell for in the Catholic Church, or that the Jehovah's Witnesses fall for. And I think it was while trying to work that out in my mind and coming to an understanding of, like, the flaws in my epistemology, like the flaws in the idea that you can just talk to yourself in your head, think about things, examine your feelings, and know cosmic truth. I mean, just that became discredited in my mind. And, you know, but I really had to discredit everything in the Book of Mormon, the Book of Abraham, you know, Joseph Smith, prayer, revelation, the Bible. You know what I'm saying? I really had to understand how all of those things had really been false before I was finally able to say, hey, okay, I really am just like everyone else in the world that belongs to these false churches. It's just that my false church happens to be the Mormon church, and that's just the way it is. But coming out of that belief, I can then take that same thought process that I've gone through and look at all the other churches, and I see the exact same flaws. They believe in the Bible, which I think is non-credible. They base their truth on feelings that they call revelation. They, you know, they have a flawed epistemology. They don't really have a viable way of identifying truth. They make the same kinds of epistemological mistakes that Mormons do. It just seemed to me that there was, you know, there's no difference. Mormonism really is just like the Mormon specific version of every other false church out there. And they're
so
all
much elaborate.
What's that?
No, never mind. I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Well, but you kind of see where I'm going here. It's like,
oh, totally.
Once I had been able to see just how comprehensively I had been fooled for my entire life by Mormonism, it's trivially easy to look at, like, the Baptists and realize that they're in the same boat, and the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Hindus and the Muslims and everybody else. You know, there's no evidence that God exists, and there's evidence that all the people who believe in these various religions fool themselves into continued belief using the same types of techniques as had fooled me growing up. And so it was just, you know, there really was no alternative to Mormonism in a religious sense that didn't have exactly the same baggage. It was just, you know, once I got to the point where I could accept that Mormonism was probably not true, there was no religion that was going to be able to do any better.
So, Seth, no, really, in that series of comments, you said that you knew Mormonism was true in the same way that you knew, you know, Arizona. I think that was your example. But obviously that's not the case. You knew that airplanes flew based on, you know, experiments, equations, proofs.
Right.
For
right,
Mormonism,
right.
You believe what your comparison is basically placing Mormonism as a pseudoscience. You thought that you knew it in the same way, but really, well, it was false method.
Actually, let me clarify that comment for a moment, because I really did kind of misstate. I didn't know that Mormonism was true with regard to the techniques for establishing true. What I really meant was the sensation of knowing, like the sureness of knowing. I don't know how, you know, like philosophers could say this a lot better than me, but, like, you know, the mental experience, or I don't know if you would want to call it a qualia or whatever, but like this, like the experience of belief, like I knew it in the sense that I believed it strongly, and I thought that that belief was sheer knowledge, and it felt like knowledge, you know, just like I could pick up a ball and drop it and know that it's going to hit the ground. Okay. I was that sure that the celestial kingdom existed. I'm not saying I had used the same techniques to arrive at that knowledge. That was the experience of knowledge. And it was actually sort of reverse engineering that knowledge and like asking myself how I knew these things and whether those techniques were valid that kind of helped unravel it for me though. So, I mean, you're right in the sense that I didn't know that Mormonism was true in the same way that scientists know things. Ultimately, that's, you know, one of the tests that Mormonism failed. For me, anyway.
Yeah, okay. I see what you mean. That's clear.
Okay, you two are obviously well-trained in scientific thinking and scientific thought and rationality and reason. Not everybody out there is. What role do you think that plays in? Is this something that can only be deconstructed, in your opinion, if you have that sort of training?
What do you mean something deconstructed?
When you deconstruct Mormonism, when you take and pull apart Mormonism and mm-hmm. left with a more rationalistic view.
Well, I don't know. Here's the funny thing, you know. My wife, not a scientist, essentially not a rational thinker either. And I asked her the other day, you know, after all these years, because I didn't really felt that I knew for sure, I asked, do you believe in God? And she said, no, I try not to think about it, but basically she also doesn't believe in God. And it's not because of any of the comparisons that, you know, to other religions that Seth has been talking about, or, you know, difficulty about the flood and evolution and those things. So I don't think that you really have to have scientific training to arrive at, you know, this place that we're talking about, you know, where Seth and I are, where, you know, really not only do you reject Mormonism, but you reject the, you know, just the concept of religion and arriving at truth in those ways.
You know, here's the thing. Here's a comment, if you don't mind. Yeah. I believe it's true that people aren't born with religious beliefs, and that those religious beliefs actually develop, you know, through cultural influences and, you know, family influences and whatnot at a later time. And that it's possible for people to grow up in, you know, like in a household or in a culture or whatever, where they simply don't have a belief in God. And I think there would be something very different. It would be very different to not believe in God because of that kind of background than to not believe in God because of the types of things that Lauren and I have gone through, where we started with faith in God and kind of had to deconstruct that and think our way out of it. You see what I'm saying? Because, mm-hmm. because now I don't believe in God for a whole list of reasons that I could even rattle off. But the person who just grew up not believing in God might not even be able to tell you why they don't believe in God. They never believed in God. So, you know, and they might not know why. So I think that there is a big difference in that. And as far as scientific training and whether or not people have to have scientific training in order to figure this sort of thing out, I don't think that they do, but I think people have to have a sort of curiosity about how things work. Because for me, like, it wasn't just knowing that Joseph Smith made up the Book of Abraham or slept with a bunch of people's wives and things like that. Those are just incidents. Those are facts. And I don't think it's sort of like people say, you know, you can't make an ought from an is. Well, you have these is's, you have these facts about the church. I don't think you can show that someone ought not to believe in the church just because of that fact. I think you have to show, at least for someone like me, you have to show, A, that there are false churches out there, that B, the Mormon church is the same as them, and that C, you were fooled like everybody else in all those other churches, and D, this is how it happened. This is how you were fooled. That's what it took for me. Maybe that's not what it took for Lauren. That's what it took for me. I had to kind of see the big picture of, well, how could I be just as wrong as the Jehovah's Witnesses that knock on my door? I mean, nobody, people tend, I think, to sort of, I don't know what you want to say, have confidence that their beliefs are true, even while acknowledging that everyone else can be just dead wrong. People tend to value their own, you know, their own thoughts and their own beliefs. And I think that makes it really hard to recognize that you might be just as wrong as everybody else is, like in a church. You know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I get some missionaries. They come to my house. I let them in. They come in and we start talking. I mention my background. We get into it a little bit. I start talking to these guys and realize that they don't really know a whole lot. They're pretty ignorant about all sorts of things, but they know that the church is true. And it doesn't even occur to them in their minds that they might be wrong. See what I mean? People have no, I don't know. I think most people, they just, it's just very difficult for them to conceive that they might be wrong. And so it will take a sort of natural curiosity to lead someone down that path. Anyway, I'll be quiet.
Well, Seth, you know, some of those missionaries may just be very good at, you know, putting on the face and bearing the testimony, even though it may not be everything that's in their hearts. I remember at one point on my mission meeting someone who was an ex-Jehovah's Witness, and we taught him a lesson, and he basically looked at us and said, "You guys don't believe this. You know, I know you don't believe this. I can see it in your eyes that you don't really have the confidence that you claim to have." And my companion and I went away a little bit trembling, you know, because at least for me, he was speaking the truth. You know, I came to admit to myself a little bit that day that it was, you know, kind of a poker face.
Huh. That's such a different experience to me. It's really interesting to hear you say that, because when I was a missionary, I mean, I totally believed it, you know. I mean, I had a companion that, you know, I tried to heal an old woman who had, you know, horrific back pains, and I actually commanded her to be healed because, you know, I didn't put any weasel words into it. I didn't say "Thy will be done" or anything else. I actually commanded her to be healed, and I thought she would be. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, I had another companion. We talked about how long it was going to be till Jesus comes down again. And, you know, I was willing to give Jesus maybe 10 years or so, given the condition of the world at the time. And he thought it was going to be within 5. You know, I mean, that's how strongly I believed.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe if this ex-Jehovah's Witness had been looking in your face, he wouldn't have tried to call you out. You know, he wouldn't have been able to see in you what he saw in me.
You know, what's funny is I now look back at that level of faith that I have as kind of a deep, you know, a deep flaw, because I've tried to make this point that people are overconfident in their own abilities, and my faith was really overconfident. You know, I believed things well beyond any justification for believing that strongly, and I didn't recognize it at the time. And now that I look back, I'm actually kind of embarrassed by that. You know, because
it's interesting you say that about, you know, well, it's kind of a prideful thing to have that level of belief. But you read the Book of Mormon, the stories of the great, you know, the great atheists, you know, Korihor, these skeptics, and they are portrayed as the prideful people. When really it's kind of prideful to have that level of self-confidence. And it takes a little bit of humility to say, "I could be wrong, or I am wrong, or I was wrong for all those years." That's a humbling thing. That's not pride, I believe.
Do you ever? Yeah, I mean, which is it's kind of ironic, and I recognize the irony of saying that you're humble, because, you know, is it really humility if you say you're humble? No, but at the same time, it's like I've had a lot of TBMs. You know, relatives or, other people on some, you know, internet boards or whatever say something like, "You're closed-minded." And I'm just like, I changed my mind. And, you know, and you haven't. And not only have you not, but you've pretty much said that nothing will ever change your mind, that you know this, and that no evidence, no argument, no nothing will ever touch your testimony. That's sort of like the whole point of a testimony is being closed-minded. You know, it's like when someone bears you their testimony and says, I know this to be true, and I'm going to do everything I can throughout my life to make sure that I keep knowing that, you know, you read the Ensign articles where it says 10 techniques to strengthen your testimony or something. That's really 10 techniques to maintain a closed mind about the subject of Mormonism. You know, it's true, and you're not going to allow any possible challenge to that to come up in your mind. You're going to do everything in your power to turn off the your mind from thinking about the possibility that might not be true. And like Lauren and I and however many other apostates there are out there, we did change our mind. And then the TBMs show up and say we're closed-minded. I mean, it's just it's funny.
Yeah, I think, Seth, you make a really good point. Going back to the question of why do so many ex-Mormons become atheists, I think to make that transition out of the church, you not only have to acknowledge that you were wrong, but you were profoundly wrong about something very, very big. And you have to be able to take that apart. And I think oftentimes once people take it apart, the level of rationalism that is required, the level of logic and reason that must be applied, once you have those tools in your chest, it's really hard to reconstruct your cosmology or whatever into some other religion that is based on the same sort of internal feeling or metaphysical experience.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to say, though, once again, though, that people who don't manage to deconstruct and, you know, rationalize, it's not because they are, you know, lacking in intelligence or lacking in education or, you know, lacking in mental fortitude or intellectual integrity. It's because they're happy where they are. And it takes an effort to do those things. You know, you have to be willing to break your heart to go through that. And a lot of people see no reason to do it. You know, it's like Pascal's wager. They accept it. They believe that if I'm wrong, I don't lose out on anything. If I'm right, I go to the celestial kingdom. I just want to reiterate once again, because I think, you know, unbelievers get a bad rap, and get labeled as being, you know, prideful and thinking that they're better than everyone else and everyone else is lacking in some way because they can't be like them. No, I absolutely don't think that's true.
Yeah.
Right. And not only do you think it's not true, but if you did think it was true, then that condemns your earlier life of belief. I mean, I was a believer for 36 years. If it was a deep character flaw to believe in Mormonism, I would have had to have been a sufferer of this character flaw for 36 years, right? I mean, if I look back on my life, it's very difficult for me to say exactly the one thing that made the difference between me no longer believing today and how things might have gone differently in my life, and I would have remained a TBM like all my relatives for the rest of my life. It's almost like there, but for the grace of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, go I. You know, I mean, it could very easily have happened because that's how much I believe. I don't know. People might say, well, do you think you're smarter than me? It's like, no, I don't. Well, what's the difference? You know, I have a hard time really saying what it is. What made me question my epistemology as opposed to continuing to practice that epistemology unchallenged? I don't know. It might be one of those quantum things where just one bit flipped in my mind and that made all the difference. I may never know because, you know, a lot of people, a lot of smart people in the church, you know, don't ever go through the process that you and I went through. And I can't say that they're flawed for that. I can't say that they're bad or that they're not smart or intelligent or anything else.
So Seth, did you completely do it on your own? You know, or did you meet, were you around people that questioned, or, you know, were you on the internet and encountered questions, or did you just completely, you know, on your own work through this?
I'll say I worked through it alone in the sense that I didn't have family members or friends or people in my ward, you know, doing that or supporting it. And I wasn't on the internet. I mean, I was on the internet since the beginning, but not in Mormon related groups. I didn't actually run across like significant, you know, apostates or, let's say boards where people argued about Mormonism until after I already didn't believe it anymore. And maybe that's why it took so long, because I did have to kind of, you know, sort of, I just had to take my own time, and my mind had to sort of think about things and just sort of chew on the problem for years and years and years before I got to that one point that made the difference between being a believer and not being a believer. And in fact, I don't know if I had had other people around challenging me, I don't know whether I would have turned into an apologist and never left the church and tried to fight them, or whether I would have jumped on the bandwagon with them. I can't say, because I used to actually defend the church. I mean, on my mission, I was like a big time apologist for thing. And, you know, I had like family members on my wife's side that sometimes would discuss troubles they were having with me, and I would actually give them like an apologetic spin on things. So I don't know.
So that's an interesting point. The convergence, or the buffer between the scientific community and Mormonism, really lies on that bleeding edge of apologetics. I'd like to hear some of your thoughts about modern Mormon apologetics and its role in this whole debate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that each piece of apologetics taken in isolation can be convincing on its own. You know, it can all be played towards, well, what if this, what if that? It's, you know, we don't know everything. Absence of evidence isn't evidence that it didn't happen. You know, in isolation, all those pieces are maybe acceptable. But if you step back and look, you know, at each one of those as a brick, you have a wall that is built of what if, you know, pie in the sky scenarios. And to me, that edifice of apologetics is just, it's really hard to, I don't understand how people can swallow that.
Yeah. In fact, you know, yeah, what Lauren says, you know, like, okay, so maybe it's possible that God really did cause Abraham to tell his story, and really did cause some Hebrew scribe to appropriate traditional Egyptian religious iconography and use it to express, you know, the story of Abraham, or to like write traditional, you know, Egyptian prayers for the dead as some sort of mnemonic device for, you know, for Abraham's story or something. I mean, you start to think to yourself, okay, this is really far-fetched. I mean, you can't say, no, this is impossible, because it's very difficult to prove a negative. But when you take the unlikeliness of it, and then you take the unlikeliness that Joseph Smith would sleep with other men's wives with God's blessing, when a lot of other cult leaders around the world, and again, I don't mean to use that term cult as like the LDS church is a cult, I don't want to go there, but you see all these other cult leaders like David Koresh and people like that sleeping with their followers, and you think to yourself, okay, so what's the likelihood that Joseph Smith doing this really is from God rather than really is from his pants like all these other people? And that's kind of improbable. And what's the probability that that a small band of Israelites could come over, meet a pre-existing population of Asian, you know, Asian ancestry, you know, like natives with Asian ancestry people in America, and then take them over and make Nephi their king and turn them all into Christians? You know, and yet for that to not leave any evidence. I mean, all those different issues, like Lauren says, apologists can try to make a cogent argument in defense of each of those, and they have more or, you know, greater or lesser success in that. But when you take each of those things where the apologetic that like supports the truth is like improbable, and then it's like an improbability multiplied by an improbability multiplied by an improbability, taking the whole picture of it together, you're like, you guys have got to be kidding me. I mean, what thinking person can actually look at all of the improbables out there and say, and now my considered opinion is that the LDS Church is undoubtedly true? I mean, it ought to be impossible. I'm not saying it is impossible. Obviously, it's not impossible for people to say that, but it ought to be.
Well, I think there are, in fact, very few Mormons who are aware that all this even goes on. Most of them are much more, you know, naive believers who aren't aware that there are these issues, or they don't care enough in the issues to even need apologetics.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, yeah, I mean, John's question about apologetics, we give kind of a vigorous answer against it, but I think for the most part, it doesn't matter.
But, you know, it mattered to me. And let me just say this. It's not every, all my participation on the various web forums and things like that, I was already a non-believer by the time I got to those boards or, you know, right after the tipping point where I was pretty much a non-believer and then a non-believer right after that. Okay. So none of that participation swayed me toward non-belief. That all happened before. What did sway me towards non-belief was reading on the internet some apologetics, because right up until I read some Mormon apologetics about, like, the Book of Abraham, for example, I was still giving the church the benefit of the doubt. I was, like, privileging all the arguments in the church's favor. Like, you know, okay, evolution is true, and Joseph Fielding Smith was wrong, but it's not relevant to my salvation. I could make those things work in my mind. But when I read things like the mnemonic device theory, or, you know, the scribes did it, or some of these, like, apologetics that like Hugh Nibley had come up with, it just was kind of a slap in the face intellectually. And I looked at those and said, these are terrible arguments. You know, I'm a member of this church that I believe in, and we're having to be defended by terrible arguments. And, you know, I read this review of the book, Mormon, or what was it? The one about Joseph, In Sacred Loneliness, right? Joseph Smith's Polygamy. And like the farms guys who reviewed the book were tearing it to shreds as if to totally discredit the whole work. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, so the book says that Joseph Smith slept with like 12 guys' wives, and the farms guys have whittled it down to like 8. That's, you know, it's like, The book maybe says that Joseph Smith was married to like 40-something extra wives, and the farms guys tear it all to shreds and arrive at like 30 or something like that. And I'm like, this is terrible. I mean, it doesn't help. They can trash the book all they want, but no matter how many wives they reduce, they can't reduce it all the way down to just Emma. And so the whole defense is just really terrible. And I just, it really did kind of tip me over. It was right then. And that I've described this before in online posts. It's like, that was the tipping point at which I went from being on the church's side. I hit that point and I said, I'm not going to accept terrible arguments anymore. I'm just going to go where the evidence leads. And once I rejected the whole notion that like intellectually crappy arguments were acceptable to me, that it was over. I mean, game over. I was a non-believer within, you know, weeks or months of that, because the evidence just is overwhelming once you stop privileging the discussion in favor of the church, and once you stop, you know, accepting really crappy answers.
All right, guys. The hour has flown by. Is there any last arguments you want to make, or anything you want to say before we close it up?
Yeah, if you don't mind. I mean, I'll make one little thing. And I'm an atheist now, but it's not that I deny the possibility of a God. It's that I just don't see A, any evidence that there is a God, B, any need for a God. In other words, all the reasons people typically argue, well, there must be a God because of such and such, I don't agree with any of those arguments. So I don't see that there's logically or rationally like a requirement for a God to be there to satisfy any of the big questions out there. And C, if there was a God, it would have to be radically different than the type of God believed in by Mormons, Christians, Muslims, and pretty much everybody else who actually has a firm belief in a God. Because I see a world out there where, you know, the word of this God is just riddled with things that are demonstrably false. So there's no credibility there. There's no reliability. There's no mechanism there by which truth can be obtained and that you can actually believe and have faith that that truth is real, that it's accurate. And you have to say that either God doesn't exist and that's why everybody has all these conflicting, you know, revelations and things like that, or God does exist, but he's not the kind of God that wants us to know about him. So, you know, in that case, there's really not much difference than there being a God, but he doesn't care about us or tell us anything, from there's, you know, there might as well not even just be a God. So I don't assume that there is a God. I kind of assume that until better and more reliable knowledge comes out about a God, that there just, you know, there probably isn't one. So that's the sort of atheist I am. But I just don't believe that there's any credibility out there in all the religious claims that people make to, like, knowing who this God is and what foods, you know, or body parts he wants us to touch and whatnot, and what clothes we have to wear and how many earrings and all this other stuff. There's just no credibility there. And that's true in Mormonism and in every other church. All right. Go ahead.
So, I kind of have a take on some of the reason, some of the purposes, you know, that people attribute to God, and how really those purposes don't answer the questions that they're meant to answer. For example, you know, why is there something instead of nothing? Or why, you know, why do we exist? Why does the world exist? Why is, are things the way it is? And they say it's because of God. But, well, why is there a God? You know, you haven't really answered the question by pointing out that there's a God, because, well, why is there a God? Another example is, you know, what is our purpose to be on earth? Well, it's because we're supposed to, you know, get a body and go to heaven and become like gods. But, and people may wonder that, you know, without God, they would feel that they had no purpose. But I could imagine God lying in bed at night and wondering to himself, why am I here? Why am I here? What is the purpose of exalting all of these human beings? You know, that sort of existential crisis, if humans can have it, why not God? You haven't answered the question by pointing to God. And so I think that you just sort of have to accept, you know, there are mysteries, there are questions, there's things that we do not know. Yes, there could be a God, but don't believe that you've answered the questions by attributing anything to the existence of God.
That's awesome, by the way. That, Lauren, that's really awesome. God lying in bed awake, you know, lying amongst this this bed with like 500 other wives going, so what is this all about, really?
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
All right, guys, it's been a great discussion. A lot of food for thought there. Maybe we'll have to have you guys back sometime to talk about some more issues of religion and science. I feel like we were just scratching the surface of the discussion, and I know I had some topics I wanted to get into that we didn't even have time to get into. So, wonderful discussion.
Thank you very much.
It was a good time. That'd be cool.
All right. Yep. You can follow the discussion more by checking out the website at MormonExpression.com, or you can call and leave us a message at 801-906-6722. You can also email us at mail@MormonExpression.com. Our music is provided by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com.